Going there for you, Chris. All right, it's rolling.
Thank you.
Thanks, Henry. Thanks to the Gloucester Writers Center for helping to put this together and make this happen. Very exciting stuff. Gloucester Writers Center is an incredible resource for our beautiful town here, a little seaside piece of heaven that we live in, right? So introduce myself. I'm Chris Anderson. I'm with Eastern Point Lit House. It's kind of this new entity I'm birthing right now. Looks painful, right? What we do is kind of, we're just kind of exploring the edges of what's possible as far as exploring what literary Gloucester is. We have a website where we publish a daily dose of lit, is what we call it. That's the website, dailydoseoflit.com. It's extracts, and we feature a different piece every day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And it starts on Monday with a video reading. On Tuesdays, we do poetry. Wednesday, we do a haiku visual art mashup, if you will. On Thursday, we do prose. And on Friday, we do an excerpt from a current small press book. We have a few other projects going on in the works. We have this new thing I've been working on with Ken Duckworth over at Duckworth's Bistro, where we're going to do a book club, where we're going to have visiting writers come in and discuss a book that really excites them and lead the discussion. We're going to drink some wine, have some fresh, seasonal, awesome appetizers, and just talk about some really cool stuff. So we have that coming up. Check out our website. Our other website, I guess, which is easternpointlithouse.com. Pretty fancy. I have postcards up by the door and little flyers for the book club. Joanne Hart's going to be participating in June. Steve's going to be coming back for it. Anna Solomon will be there and a few other people, and it's going to be really exciting and fun. So I hope you guys will keep an eye on that. We're going to aim for like a 5 o'clock start time for that, so anything that happens at the Writing Center at 7:30, you can get there for it. Right? It's all about partnerships and figuring things out together. So, without further ado, let's talk about who we have here tonight. Right? Notes. I'm going to do two introductions for each of these guys, because one's like the official introduction, and then I'll give like the unofficial. Maybe I'll get my kids up to introduce Steve. It'll be fun. I believe first tonight we're going to have David Krause up here. David Krause is an award-winning short story writer and teacher. His collection for short fiction, Copycats, received the Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction in 2005 and was nominated for the Penn Faulkner the following year. A second collection, The Man Back There, was published in 2008 by Sarabande Books and was awarded the Mary McCarthy Prize in short fiction. His stories have appeared in some of this country's most well-regarded journals, including Greensboro Review, Chelsea Quarterly, West, and the Beloit Fiction Journal. His comic book writing has been anthologized in the Dark Horse Book of the Dead, published by Dark Horse Comics. And he's just always doing all kinds of interesting things. Here's the other introduction. I met David about 14 years ago when I was reinventing my life. I was a very non-traditional student. I hadn't finished my undergrad education, but I knew I wanted to study writing. And so I left my home in Texas, and I moved to New England. And I went to a little college called Bradford College, which was in Haverhill. And I say was, because I was there for a year when they closed. It's over 200-year-old school, and they closed. Yeah, that's what happens to my schools. It's a long story. So anyway, my life was in flux. I think so was David's to an extent, and he eventually took a job at another smaller school, which seems like a good idea, right? He called me up one day and he said, "Hey man, you should come out and finish what we started. We should finish what we were working on together." And so I did. I went out there, and it was incredible. I was able to really just study mostly one-on-one with David, and it was the greatest gift. It was awesome. So eventually I went off to do my MFA back in Texas. And then at the end of that, David calls me up and he says, "Hey, you want a like part-time job back up here?" I'm like, "Sure, sounds good." Anyway, I came up and he got me this incredible job at the college where I graduated from, and he split for Alaska. I was like, so anyway, long story short, we've been friends for a long time now. We've gone through a few things together, and really, it's been awesome and difficult and all of it good. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce the incredible, most awesome David Krause.
Yeah, he makes it sound like I just hightailed it to Alaska with like a sled dogs and stuff. But, yeah. That introduction meant a lot to me. I mean, it covers so much time, and just the fact that you mentioned 14 years is amazing to me that we've known each other for that long. So thank you, Chris, for bringing me to the center, and thanks to the center for hosting this event. About 4 years ago, I decided I was going to start a novel, and about a month ago, 2 months ago, I finished it. So that's what I've been doing the last 4 years. Now wait till you hear it. But and it was interesting because I felt like, okay, this is a departure for me. When I finished the novel and really took a step back from it, I feel like everything that I was doing in my short stories is in the novel as well. And I think Flannery O'Connor's, I'm paraphrasing here, but her comments about a writer's obsessions being very narrow and deep are very true in my case. I write about the same things in very different ways over and over and over again, right? And so I'll explain a little bit of that, and then I'll just give you the first, I don't know, 10 pages of the book, I think, and you'll get a flavor for it. But I take very small things. I don't live a very interesting life. So as a fiction writer, I have to take very small things and turn them into very much larger things. I have to take a thing that's not really much of a problem, more of a complaint, and turn it into an actual kind of dramatic problem. So in my life, I've always been very interested in these kind of moments where, well, Steve, you would know this. Steve hurt his back recently. He was saying he's in a little pain. And I know as someone who's also hurt his back in the past that you have this kind of conversation with someone. You say, oh, I hurt my back. And they say, oh, I hurt my back last year, right? And you go, oh, and you talk about it a little bit. And you feel maybe a little better, right? There's someone else there who sympathizes with you, and you don't feel quite as alone. But then you also have this conversation. You go, oh, I hurt my back. And someone says, oh, I stubbed my toe. I know what, and you go, wait, no, this is starting to move further apart. Do you understand, actually? We're starting to get a little isolated here. You know, my aunt, who I was very close to, she just passed away recently. And then the other person says, oh, you know, my cat died last year. Okay, well, yeah, maybe we can talk about this, I guess. Right? So I'm very interested in that that space between, you know, sincere empathy and then a kind of weird solipsism, this kind of a person being trapped in their own perspective, and the way that we try to understand each other's pain by looking deeply at our own, right? So sometimes you can kind of go into yourself and come out and actually understand the other person, and sometimes you get stuck in there, as in the example of the woman with the cat saying to the other woman, oh yeah, I know what you mean. So it was interesting when I finished this novel, saying to myself, well, David, you're right back there again. That's exactly what this novel is about. It's just on a much larger scale. So the two central characters in the book, they're a married couple, and the man is, he grew up in America, in the Midwest, and is a child of an alcoholic. And there's maybe some implication that there's some abuse there. That's kind of his cat, right? And the woman is, Miha is her name. She's from South Korea. And originally she was actually going to be a more minor character in the book, but she actually has taken over the book and become, in my mind, the main character. And she is actually someone who survived being a sex worker in South Korea. This is something I got into and researched and really got obsessed with as I was writing the book. And actually was able to get out of that and come to America and recreate herself. And as the book takes place, she's actually quite successful and is living kind of a dream life with her husband. So they both have these pasts that are brought to bear on the relationship. And part of the question of the book is, this: does this allow them to understand each other, or does it actually result in this kind of isolation of the two of them? And I'll just leave it at that. That's really all you need to know to hear this scene. So it's a short scene. It'll give you just a kind of flavor of things. You should also know, maybe just this little detail, is that it takes place maybe 15 years ago during the time of the Seattle protests, when people were protesting the World Bank, and you turned on the TV and you saw young people in like masks throwing little, you know, rocks and stuff at windows, and police throwing tear gas back at them, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what this scene is about. So, okay. She told him everything, but in careful portions. The long journey from South Korea when she was 9, the strangeness of the small Midwestern town, and even the strangeness of her new parents. The strangeness of having parents, people who cared for you in their own awkward, imperfect way. Strange, she kept saying when she told him. The house was small, with a hiding place behind the couch where she kept her best toys lined along the baseboard heater. She took violin lessons and played with the family cat. She sat on the floor and watched TV, and her mother moved around in the kitchen, back and forth between the sink and stove. Strange, strange, strange. He was surprised to find himself feeling jealous of that girl on the floor. He had experienced none of that. He told her stories too, but his was a generic tragedy. His father had been a drunk, his mother an apologist. She had waited a long time to tell him. This was in their first year of marriage, and they had entered it the way a person might enter a train bound for a faraway place, with that same sense of weary optimism. In fact, he liked to think of it like that. He could imagine the train, the passengers in pairs, the click and rush of heat, all that mechanical ritual. Romantic, yes, he admitted that, but the decision had also been a pragmatic as planning a funeral, a thing that needed to be done. He remembered saying, "Now we can start over," but hadn't she already done that years before? At the wedding, his mother needed help down the aisle, shrunken small as a child with a child's innocence too. Somehow she had made it to the end of her life with that intact. His brother took her shoulder, guided her to the first pew, and whispered something in her ear. She was beaming. This was a vindication. His father was just a memory by then, although she spoke about him in the present tense, as if he had just slipped out for a moment. They stood in front of the small crowd, and the priest tripped over her name just as he had done in rehearsal. She just laughed, and their friends and family laughed along. "Miha," he said to himself, the name he had rehearsed speaking when they had first met. By what miracle had she arrived here, standing in front of him in white? She seemed to have pulled the same trick his mother had, but one better, because no illusions had been necessary, no softening of one's perspective. She laughed, and they laughed along. It was as simple as that. When it was all finished, she said, "Here we go." And they released themselves from the ceremony. He grew to think of their fourth and last year as the difficult year, although its roots were found in the year before and even the year before that, when they first arrived in that small Massachusetts town and Miha was visited by her dreams of drowning. He awoke in the middle of the night to find her sitting up, staring off into the dark, and he'd say, "Another one?" And she'd say, "Yes." And then they'd talk about something else until they fell asleep again. Who knew how long she'd stay up or what she was thinking about? He had become a spectator to some private struggle. At best, he could hope to be a tourist in her dilemma, And at worst, well, sometimes upon waking, it seemed like the stupidest thing to speak to that shape in the bed next to him. She might, after all, be on the verge of something. And all he was doing was pulling her back. Back into what? Into the marriage, the mundane artifacts of life. You should sleep, he told her sometimes, as if the idea had never occurred to her. At first, she explained the dreams not as visions of drowning, but of swimming. But the threat of drowning was always in there, in the expanse of black water, the indistinct horizon. And when he first used the word drowning, she said, yes, yes, drowning. That's what it is, isn't it? She was trying to go someplace far away, but she didn't have the strength. The waters were cold and deep. She said that she wouldn't be so upset if she knew where she wanted to go. The blindness of purpose. That was what made her distraught. In the day, she was a different person. Confident, charismatic even. They walked to school and parted ways with a kiss on the cheek. A few hours later, she left her classroom trailing an entourage of students. He joined them, tagged along, listened to her speak about things he didn't understand. It was a time, he realized later, when the world did not exist outside of that small town. They fell deeply into that existence, made calls back to report their cautious happiness, as if they were traveling in an exotic place, a place where anything might happen. But their lives consisted of what, really? Dinners in small restaurants, bicycle rides, occasional drinks with acquaintances on a Saturday night. It was the dreams, he thought, that seemed to come from someplace else, and only them. How many had there been? No more than a dozen, he guessed, but there seemed to be many more. Once he asked her, don't think about where you're trying to go. Think about what's behind you. What do you think you're leaving? That's a good question, she said from the darkness. Well, you're trying to get me to talk about Korea, she said. All I can say is not to worry. There's no connection, so don't look for one. But the dreams continued, sent to her from that other place. They seemed like the price one must pay for a good life, some sacrifice she made so their days could be harmonious. And months later, when the scrambling bodies appeared on the TV, moving en masse across the screen, it was as if the dreams had foretold this. Or maybe it was as simple as this. Television was a kind of dream, and sometimes even more senseless and weird than a dream. Or this. The panic on the TV could be exited at any moment, simply by turning away and returning to the world of routine. It was late November 1999, and the fridge was still full of holiday leftovers. Miha and John watched the people surge and then retreat, and then he said to her, I don't understand. But she didn't answer. She was in the grip of it, and he couldn't reach her. On the TV screen, someone wearing a rag around his face lit a bottle and hurled it at the police. It struck a plastic riot shield and exploded in an ornament of smoke and fire. The riot shield was one of many, a row of 15 moving steadily forward against the crowd. The police wore masks, so did almost everyone else. Of course, the dream had not predicted this at all, but there was a symmetry here, a lyrical connection, if not a causal one. These pictures on the TV seemed to come from that same place. They shared that same irrational pull on the attention, the same resistance to sense and meaning. She stood there mesmerized by them, and he watched her as much as the television. Her body did not move. It was as if she had left it behind. There was something wrong with him or something wrong with her, and he wanted to find out which. I feel like I'm going to cry, she said. He sat dumbfounded, eating his dessert. They had just stepped into a new millennium, and maybe this was how things were going to be from now on. The black batons rose in the air as one and then came down spasmodically, flailing at whatever skull or shoulder was closest. People buckled to the pavement, dragged themselves backward, and a kid, he couldn't have been more than 16, hurled himself onto the hood of a patrol car, danced awkwardly down its length and away from the cop who just a second before had been ready to club him down. The announcers were talking because, after all, that's what they were supposed to do, but their commentary seemed as useless as his own internal monologue, and he wished he could stop them both and simply focus on the event itself. in all its splintered ugliness. He reminded himself that although this was happening far away, it was still America, and it was still now. "I'm not going to cry," Miha said, and then he thought, wait, this is just like the dream. He felt that helpless. He couldn't get worked up about the people on the screen. He couldn't even see their faces after all, but he could get worked up about his wife, who was edging closer to the images, holding her glass with both hands. He would not have been surprised if she had simply let it drop. The cops were moving in a rough triangle, like a flock of geese, he thought. Smoke partially obscured the storefronts, but he could make out the signs of places he knew, McDonald's and Kinko's and Starbucks. The signs and logos grounded the proceedings in a way that was especially unsettling. The body scrambled backward toward a safe place, but when they arrived there, that safe place wasn't safe at all. Some people seemed to be moving in slow motion, and others seemed to be moving incredibly fast. They all contributed to the overall confusion. More streams of fire swirled from somewhere in the middle of the crowd, hit the pavement, set clouds pillowing in all directions. The camera shook, flipped toward the sky for a moment, and when it found its orientation again, the images had changed. The anarchist A spray-painted on a pink-tinted storefront window, the dresses still untouched behind the glass, hooded figures in black running up the sidewalk. It was difficult to see what was happening, and Miha moved in for a closer look. She seemed about to push her face into the screen. He felt it too, that urge to close the distance to zero. Maybe joining in would eradicate the mystery, but of course, there was no way to join in. It was happening on the other side of the country, and all this intimacy was just trickery brought to him by the TV. The crowd seemed to find a common purpose and surged forward. The commentators were giving statistics on property damage and injuries, as if this were a natural disaster, a hurricane or earthquake. Miha said, "I'm such an idiot. I'm crying now." Was that triumph he detected in her voice? Regal. That was a word that occurred to him. And defiance. She stood there with her hands full and did not even bother to wipe her face. Touching her would be a violation, so he stood up, trying to join her in attentive pose. But that felt wrong too, and then he was leaving, heading to the kitchen. He took a position at the sink and began to run the water over the dishes. She didn't call for him to come back, and as he rinsed and stacked the cups, dried the cast iron pan, the sense of accomplishment returned those images to their proper sense of proportion. He placed the two wine glasses upside down in the dish drainer, squeezed the sponge dry. But the emotional charge was real, the images were real, Miha's feelings were real too. And that's truly what gave the news importance. He cleaned each dish, taking his time. When he was done, he stepped back into the living room, hands still wet. She turned her head slightly to acknowledge his return and said, "Tear gas." "Okay," he said. It was difficult to know who to root for, but his instinct was to cheer for the side without uniforms. They were obviously losing, and that made them more sympathetic, despite the announcer's comments about looting and pillaging. Also, they showed a sense of humor. One of them threw confetti at the police, the splinters of multicolored paper exploding in clusters. And the same man, he would end up fetal, knees to chin, a baton coming down on his ribs. That almost seemed to be part of the joke, something he had planned. The blows came down, one, two, three, and then the camera toggled to someplace else. He saw it all happening right there on the TV, and so did Miha. And yes, she was crying, and yes, he allowed himself to think, how late is this going to go? "It's from Seattle," she said. "I know," he said. "That's what they're saying." "What's the World Bank?" She told him to shush and listen, but she couldn't stay quiet herself. She repeated the announcer's words to him, and he didn't mind. Nothing about this seemed absurd. In a way, it felt comforting. The cameraman had to move to another location. Things were getting difficult. "He's moving to another location," she said. He had to admit that he had very little idea of what a World Bank was or why this was happening. Occasionally, photographs of men in business suits appeared on the screen with their names beneath them. Some of the names were exotic, but the men did not look exotic. Each one looked the same as the last. The only difference is a receding hairline, a crooked nose. Was it important to remember these people? Because obviously that wasn't going to happen. Now the crowd is getting restless. she said. That's what the announcer had said, and it made just as little sense when repeated by his wife. Her face was beautiful as he'd ever seen it, but he didn't know why, except that she was interested, and she was crying. He had never seen her cry except in those early days. And when she said, I will talk about this, but don't ask me too many questions. I don't like to talk about those days. And even then, the crying had been different. This was out of control. She was sobbing. If it had not been her, he would have thought, you fake, you sham artist. Because how could somebody react that way to something on a TV screen? Please, she said, don't, when he reached up to flick the stupid thing off. But she didn't have any dreams that night. And that didn't mean, excuse me, she didn't have any dreams that night, but that didn't mean anything. Most nights were dreamless. Still, it would have surprised him if they had come. So that's the opening of the book.
Thanks, David. Awesome. Okay, time for part one introduction for our next reader. Steve Allman is the author of 10 books of fiction and nonfiction, 3 of which he has published himself. His memoir, Candy Freak, was a New York Times bestseller. His short stories have appeared in the Best American and Pushcart anthologies. His most recent collection, God Bless America, won the Patterson Prize for Fiction and was shortlisted for the Story Prize. His journalism has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, GQ, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. Which is kind of fancy. I like it. How did I meet Steve? Let's see. It happened to be at the college where David had invited me to teach, and we had this really wonderful endowment, so we always had an opportunity to have some really killer writers out. We had George Saunders, Mary Gateskill, Andre DeBuse III, we had David, we had come back from Alaska, all kinds of great writers. But, I was like, we need somebody to really energize these students and really kind of get them excited about writing, in a real, real fun way. And so I was like, we got to get Steve. He's a great reader. I'd seen him once before, many years before, when he read at a Borders bookstore where I was working back in the day. He was reading these filthy little stories, and all the people were shopping, and it was kind of awesome. It was a lot of fun. So anyway, we had Steve out to Chester, especially after I had read Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, which is kind of a memoir of his life as a music freak, if you will. And I recognized so much of myself in that book that I was like, I got to hang out with this guy. I got to talk to this guy. And then we met. We had him out at the college, and then we found out we had kids the same age. We both had 2 kids. He's got a 3rd coming. We have kids, and the moment they met, they fell in love with each other, and so ever since, it's been really a gift to hang out with Steve and Aaron and the Almonds, and our kids look upon Steve as their uncle that they like to beat the crap out of, which is very true. Steve likes to wrestle with the kids, and boy, it's everything Atticus can do right now from just not running over there and tackling Steve. Thank God for his heart back. Anyway, without further ado, let's welcome Steve Allman to the stage.
Okay, well, thanks. And thanks to the center and to Eastern Point. It's exciting to kind of be in on the ground floor. Especially to hear David read from his new novel. This is beautiful, and I can't imagine the relief that you would feel after working for that long to finish a novel. And I literally mean, I can't imagine it. Because I think really, as I've sort of looked back unpleasantly on, I always say, well, I'm just an extremely productive failed novelist. I just keep trying to write novels, and I keep failing. And so then I turn to other stuff. Which is okay, You got to have a process. So that's my process. So the other thing I was struggling with is it's so rare to see children at one of my readings for reasons that will soon become apparent. But I was thinking, do I have any stories that would appeal to these children in any way other than just as a kind of traumatic fascination? And then I realized I do have a story about UFOs. So I already have you, so that's great. Stay with me. But I'm going to read this short story, and then I will read just a little, slightly more than PG-13 excerpt from another book. Yeah, this story is called The Soul Molecule. Soul Molecule. I was on my way to see Wilkes. We were going to have brunch. Wilkes was a minor friend from college. He played number one on the squash team. I challenged him once during a round robin, and he annihilated me with lobs. Afterwards, in the showers, he told me his secret. Vision, he said, you have to see what's going to happen. Now it was 5 years on, and I still felt sort of indebted to him. This was idiotic, but I couldn't unpersuade myself. I kept remembering those lobs, one after another, as elegant as parasols. Wilkes was in the back of the restaurant in a booth. We said our hellos, and he picked up his menu and set it down again. We've known each other a long time, haven't we, Jim? Sure, I said. 8 years now, coming up on 8? That sounds about right. You wouldn't think less of me if I told you something, would you? Heck no, I said. Mostly I was wondering how much breakfast would cost and whether I'd have to pay. I've got a cartridge in my head, Wilkes said. He had that drowsy pinch around the eyes you see in certain leading men. He was wearing a blue blazer with discreet buttons. He looked like the sort of guy from whom other guys would buy bonds. That was his business. He was in bonds. A cartridge has been placed in my head for surveillance purposes. This was done a number of years ago by a race of superior beings. I don't know if you know anything about abduction, Jim. Do you know anything about abduction? Wait a second, I said. An abduction can take one of two forms. The first, you don't need to know the technical terms. The first is purely for research purposes, cell harvesting, that kind of thing. The second involves implants, Jim, such as the one in my brain. Wilkes was from Maryland, the Chesapeake Bay area. He spoke in these crisp, prepared sentences. I'd always thought he'd be a corporate lawyer with an office in a glass tower and a secretary better looking than anyone I knew. It is funny. I appreciate that. You be my laugh leader. Oh, that was a sneeze. It's also somewhat pollen-y, that line. Okay. Let's see. You're telling me, so our narrator says, you're telling me you've been abducted, I said. Wilkes nodded. He picked up his fork and balanced it on his thumb. The cartridges can be thought of as visual recorders, something like cameras. They allow the caretakers to monitor human activity without causing alarm. The caretakers, I said. They see whatever I see. Wilkes gazed at me for a long moment. It was eerie, like staring into the big black space where an audience might be. Finally, he looked up and half rose out of his seat. Mom, he said. Dad, hey there. Hey, there you are. Remember Jim? Why, of course, said his mother. She was a southern lady with one of those soft handshakes. Pleasure, said Mr. Wilkes. Unexpected pleasure. No, don't make a fuss. We'll just settle in. What are you up to, Jim? How you bringing in the pesos? Research, I said. His face brightened. Research, eh? The research game? What's that, biotech? Yeah, sort of. I'd never done any research, but I liked the way the word sounded. It sounded broad and scientific and beyond reproach. Your folks, Mr. Wilkes said, you'll remember us to them, I hope, Mrs. Wilkes said. I had no recollection of my parents having met the Wilkeses. What are you two bird dogs up to? Mr. Wilkes said. He was from Connecticut, but he sometimes enjoyed speaking like a Texan. I'll pause to note that this was written before the Bush administration. Wilkes was squeezed next to his dad, and his voice was full of that miserable, complicated family shit. We were talking, he said. I was telling Jim about the cartridge in my head. Mr. Wilkes fixed him with a look, and I thought for a second of that Goya painting, Saturn wolfing his kids down like chicken fingers. Mrs. Wilkes began fiddling with the salt and pepper as if she might want to knit with them eventually. "What about that?" Mr. Wilkes said. "What do you think of that, Jim?" "Interesting," I said. "Interesting? That the best you can do? Come on now, this is the old cartridge in the head, the old implant-a-rooney." I started to think right then about this one class I'd taken sophomore year, the biology of religion. The professor was a young guy who was doing research at the medical school. He told us the belief in a higher power was a function of biological desire, a glandular thing. The whole topic got him very worked up. Mr. Wilkes said, "Do you know why they do it, Jim?" "Sir?" He turned to his son again. "Did you explain the integration phases to him, the hybrids, the grays, anything?" "He just got here," Wilkes said. Mr. Wilkes was sitting across from me. He was one of these big Republicans you sometimes see, the gin blossoms, the blue blazer. His whole aura screamed, "Yacht." "They teach you any folklore in that fancy college of yours?" Mr. Wilkes said. "Fairy, dieback, goblin, sprite, ring a bell, Jim? These are the names the ancients used to describe our extraterrestrial caretakers. Their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning." "That's straight from the book of Ezekiel. What's that sound like to you, son? Does that sound like God on his throne of glory?" "No," I said, "I guess not." "There's a reason Uncle Sam launched Project Blue Book," Mr. Wilkes said. "He was forced to, Jim. Without some kind of coherent response, there'd be no way to stem the panic. Let me ask you something. Do you know how many sightings have been reported to the Department of Defense in the past 10 years? Guess. 2.5 million. Abductions, 700,000 plus. They are among us, Jim." Our waitress had appeared. "Do you serve egg beaters?" Mr. Wilkes said. The waitress shook her head. "Toast," Mrs. Wilkes said. "You can have some toast, dear." "I don't want toast," Mr. Wilkes said. Wilkes looked pretty much entirely miserable. "What about egg whites?" Mr. Wilkes said. "Can you whip me up an omelet with egg whites?" The waitress shifted her weight from one haunch to the other. She was quite beautiful, though dragged down by circumstance. "An omelet with what?" she said. "The white part of the egg, the part that isn't the yolk." Mr. Wilkes picked up his fork and began to simulate the act of scrambling eggs. "I'm asking you what you want in the omelet, sir." "Oh, I see. Okay. How about mushroom Swiss and bacon?" "Bacon?" Mrs. Wilkes said. I didn't know what the hell to order. The waitress left, and Mr. Wilkes turned right back to me. He'd done some fundraising for the GOP, and I could see just how effective he might be in this capacity. "Mrs. Wilkes and I, we both have implants. It's no secret. Not uncommon for them to tag an entire family. Did Jonathan already explain this?" "I didn't explain anything," Wilkes said. "You didn't give me a chance." "Yes," Mrs. Wilkes said. "You mustn't dominate the conversation, Warren." "Remember Briggs?" Wilkes said. "Who?" "Briggs. Ron Briggs played number 4 on the team. He's got an implant. He lives out in Sedona now." "Do we know him?" Mrs. Wilkes said. Mr. Wilkes waved his hand impatiently. "Now, I'm not going to bore you with some long story about our abduction, Jim. How would that be? You show up for breakfast and you have to listen to that. What you need to understand is the role these beings play. If they wanted to destroy us, if that was their intent, hell, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. They're caretakers, Jim, an entire race of caretakers. I'm not trying to suggest that these implants are any bed of roses, mind you. You got all the beta waves to contend with, the ringing. Val's got a hell of a scar." Mrs. Wilkes blushed. She had an expensive hairstyle and skin that looked a bit irradiated. "He's going to think we're kooks," she said. "Not at all," I said quietly. "Hell, we are kooks," said Mr. Wilkes. "The whole damn species is kooks. Only a fool would deny it." I waited for the silence to sort of subside and excused myself. I needed some cold water on my ears. I filled the sink and did a quick dunk and stared at the bathroom mirror, really stared, until my face got all big-eyed and desperate. When I got back to the table, the food had arrived and the Wilkeses were eating in this extremely polite manner. I'd visited them once on the way back from a squash match at Penn. All I could remember about their homes was the carpets. They must have had about 1,000 of them, beautiful and severe, the kind you didn't even want to step on. I couldn't imagine a kid growing up in that place. My French toast was sitting there with some strawberries, but I wasn't hungry. Mrs. Wilkes frowned. Is something wrong with your food, dear? We can order something else. That was pretty funny, I said finally. You guys really had me going. You must be quite the charades family. The Wilkeses, all of them, looked at me. It was that look you get from any kind of true believer, this mountain of pity, sort of wobbling on a pea of doubt. I thought about my biology professor again. Toward the end of class, just before I dropped out, in fact, he gave us a lecture about this one chemical that gets released by the pineal gland. He called it the soul molecule because it triggered all kinds of mystical thoughts. Just a pinch of this was enough to have people talking to angels. It was the stuff that squirted out at death when the spirit is said to rise from the body. Mr. Wilkes was talking about the binary star system Zeta Reticuli and the Taus hum and the Oz effect, but you could tell he wasn't saying what he really wanted to. His face was red with the disappointed blood. The waitress came and cleared the dishes. Wilkes started to mention a few mutual friends, guys who made me think of loud cologne and urinals. Mrs. Wilkes excused herself and returned to the table with fresh makeup. Mr. Wilkes laid down a 50. It was one of those rituals, and like all our rituals, it gave him this little window of expansiveness. I don't know the exact game plan, Jim. Anyone tells you they do, head the other direction. But I do know that these beings, these grays, they are essentially good. Why else would they travel 37 light years just to bail our sorry asses out? It's the mission that affects me, he said. Mrs. Wilkes and Jonathan and I, all of us, we feel a part of something larger. He gazed at his wife and son and smiled with a tremendous vulnerability. I know how it looks from the outside, but we don't know everything. We all make mistakes. He tried to say something else, but his big schmoozy baritone faltered. Mrs. Wilkes put her hand on his. What the hell do I know? Mr. Wilkes said. We all make mistakes, his wife said. I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect, love. There was a lot passing between them. Wilkes started to blush. His father seemed to want to touch his cheek. They're just trying to save us from ourselves so we don't ruin everything. The waitress had come and gone and left change on the table. All around us, people were charging through their mornings toward God knows what. The Wilkeses were sitting there in their nice clothing, but I was seeing something else now, these whitish blobs at the center of their bodies. It was their spirits I was seeing. I wasn't scared or anything. Everyone's a saint when it comes to the naked spirit. The other stuff just sort of grows over us like weeds. I thought about that crazy professor again. He'd called me to his office after Thanksgiving to tell me I was flunking. He was all torn up, as if he'd somehow betrayed me. He asked if I'd learned anything at all in his class. I said, of course I had. I'd learned plenty of things. But when he pressed me to name one or two, I drew a blank. Just before I left, he came over to my side of the desk and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "We all need someone to watch over us, James." Do you believe that? Mr. Wilkes said. I was pretty sure I'd never see the three of them again, and it made me a little sad, a little reluctant to leave. Wilkes was smoothing down his lapels. Mrs. Wilkes smiled with her gentle teeth, and Mr. Wilkes began softly, invisibly, to weep. His spirit was like a little kerchief tucked into that big blue suit. I think we're going to be all right, I said. That's the feeling I get. This was true. I was, in fact, having some kind of clairvoyant moment. Everything that was about to happen, I could see just before it did. Outside, up in the sky, above even the murmuring satellites, an entire race of benevolent yayas was maybe peering down at me with glassy black eyes. I started waving. The waitress breezed by and blew me a kiss. Mr. Wilkes slid another 50 across the table and winked. The sun lanced through a bank of clouds and lit the passing traffic like tinsel. I Wave Like Hell. Okay. Thank you. That is, in fact, a story about UFOs. Does anybody have an implant? Or I feel like, I guess you wouldn't tell us you did, but... So then, the other thing I wanted to read was just a little excerpt that will have some adult material here that's from this book, which brings me to you, which is a novel, but I wrote it with somebody else, so it doesn't really count. And it's an epistolary novel. It's in letters. This couple of people in their mid-30s meet at a wedding. They immediately, they're single and kind of screwed up. And they immediately proceed to the coat room and start messing around, and then they decide, wait a second, there's actually something interesting happening, and so they agree to not sleep together. This is where you know it's fiction. They agree not to sleep together. Instead, they're going to write each other letters about their past relationships to sort of see if they can reveal themselves before they get naked. So this is just a little section where the male character, Jim, is talking about one of his old loves. And she's an older woman who is the arts and crafts teacher at this camp that he works at. He's about 19 years old. Let's see, where is it here? So he goes over to the house where she's staying, and he's very nervous about it. We drank a bottle of wine and ate some apples and cheese. We talked about whatever we talked about. Eve, that's the woman, obviously, had a bump in her nose I wanted to kiss. She smoked with a nonchalance I found unbearably sexy. Do you want to take a hot tub, she said. I didn't bring a suit. That's okay, she said. I still didn't get it. I couldn't quite convince myself that an adult woman would take much interest in me. When you grow up in the shadow of an older sister spun from gold, when you spend your pubescent years in the orbit of all her golden friends, you tend to think of yourself as invisible to older women, or maybe not invisible exactly, but off the map sexually. It's not true. I remember all too well the way Lisa's friends handled me, that's his older sister, mussed my hair, stroked my cheeks, brushed against me, how, only half meaning to, they fed a confusion of lewd and motherly gestures into the bubbling cauldron of my hormones and watched them boil up into a terrified desire. It was all perfectly sweet and vicious. And if we're going to lay it all out there, I should confess that I was deeply in love with Lisa herself, and that this love was brotherly admiration mainly, but also contained germs of a less wholesome variety. And I should mention that she's down in South America and has disappeared. She goes down to Nicaragua and she's disappeared. The sister. Eve opened the back door and stepped into the backyard. There was a wooden deck and a hot tub. A soft light was shining somewhere out of view. Eve unhooked her overalls and let them drop to the ground. She pulled off her t-shirt. She stepped out of her little white panties. There was nothing showy in these actions. She was utterly relaxed in her body. She went to take the cover off the hot tub. Steam rose from the surface of the water and clung to her body. Are you coming in? She said. I nodded. The rim caught a little as Eve slid herself down into the tub, and the pale swell of her bottom caught the light. I stepped back into the shadows and removed my clothing very slowly and folded my underwear and my pants and my shirt and my sweater and rolled up my belt. I had overdressed. And I guess I'm just going to spell out some words here, just so you know, and waited for my goddamn boner to relent. Eve made a sound of pleasure. It's nice. Shall I get some towels? I said. Oh, S-H-I-T, she said, towels. They're these very, it's a very prim couple, so they spell out all the naughty words.
It's kind of sexier
that way. Very interesting effect. She got out of the tub and walked toward me. I was in, what, a minor panic? I hopped from one foot to the other, gave my boner a stern little whack, which my boner, blessed stupid Cro-Magnon soul, actually enjoyed. This was not something I'd done before, to get naked in front of a woman in such a casual way. I didn't know the rules. Getting a boner seemed, well, gauche. was happening here? Were we going to have sex in the hot tub? Were there neighbors at issue? I'd eased myself onto this little brick path near the back door. Eve came and stood in front of me. "Are you okay?" she said. "Is this making you feel uncomfortable?" "No," I said. "I don't want you to feel uncomfortable." "Not at all." I had been sort of hunched over in a bogus, just checking the ground for change pose. To prove just how comfortable the whole situation was making me, I straightened up. I had back then the body of a 19-year-old. I was lean and muscled and terribly insecure. If a girl was within 50 feet of me, I flexed everything. Eve examined my body in the same concerted way she'd taken a painting, a gaze that might be mistaken for adoration, but was really more like ravenous perception. And I felt an excruciating pleasure. A part of me wanted to run away. Another part of me wanted to leap forward. Eve's gaze scrolled down my torso, then stopped. "I see," she said huskily. "All right, I'll stop there." I got it. I got to stop there. It's truly a book that is filled with filth. Every other word is going to be spelled out, and they're complicated words to spell. So, but I will mention, just in case people are interested, Chris mentioned having a third baby, and so as a result of this, our very small house is now filled with my crap, and part of my crap, actually an embarrassingly significant amount of my crap, are remaindered books. And in an effort to get rid of them in as dignified but quick a manner as possible, I have just decided to get rid of them as quickly as I can by selling them for $5, plus a potato peeler. So if anybody wants to make that happen, my wife would be delighted, and I'll have them up here. I don't do credit cards, but we can do it just drug dealer style. Thank you, guys.
Go away yet. We're going to have these guys come back up here and do a quick Q&A.
Not TNA, Q&A.
I think I'm going to start this off. There's always that weird, awkward silence when the first question needs to be asked of Q&A. So I thought I'd just throw, I've known these guys again for a while, and I wanted to talk to them maybe. I know they're both music freaks. And I just kind of wanted to ask you guys, what is it about music? How does music speak to you as a writer, do you think? Or does it?
Yeah. And you actually play music, so you're better qualified.
I wouldn't say I'm better qualified, but I think because this was my first novel that I was writing, I wanted to put everything in it. There's that kind of thing that you have to stop yourself from doing maybe sometimes, but later on there's a lot of music in there. I think there's just lots of different ways music affects my work. I mean, there are, you know, obviously the certain lyric writers that I really, really get into and that kind of thing. But I also think that one thing I think is really cool about listening to more complicated forms of music like jazz and that kind of thing is that you start noticing these structures that are not necessarily intuitive as a fiction writer, but they start seeping in to you, and then you start kind of, wow, actually I can do this and kind of return to a theme that I set up, and I can kind of set it up like a song, you know? There are certain things in that opening section even that are almost like a little chorus, like, oh, she's crying. Remember, she's crying. She's crying. That kind of thing. So some of that, I think those kind of structural motifs are actually coming from songs, the way I'm thinking of people like John Coltrane or something sets up a song. That's incredibly pretentious, what I just said. But
I'll bring it down.
Yeah. Mention like the Sex Pistols or something so that we'll balance it out a little. I also feel like we're wearing the same glasses. I feel self-conscious that we... Yeah. So there's stuff like that I find really just kind of nurturing about music. And it's also, I think, this is the last thing, I'll shut up about this, but I think it's also great to listen to this art form that I'm actually not very good at and that is inspiring because it's kind of mysterious. Because I've been doing writing for a while and I know more of the ins and outs of it, and sometimes, not always, that can kind of make it seem just a little more like a job. But music always just seems fresh and exciting to me. So it's just, at the very simple level of like emotional inspiration, it's fantastic.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing that I recognized when I was in grad school, when I was writing really very boring stories. And I was listening to music whenever I'm writing, all the time. And the main thing that I realized from listening to music is that musicians are not... for the most part, they are trying very clearly physically with their bodies and their instruments to make you feel things. And writers, I think, certainly I as a young writer, was very caught up in the idea that seriousness resided in some subtle manipulation of the language that wasn't really about forcing myself to feel things or forcing the reader to feel things. And when I'd listen to music, the thing that struck me is that they're trying to break your heart. Or they're trying to sex you up or get you psyched or, you know, get you to dwell in your grievance in a very visceral, emotional way. And it was more about emotionally emboldening me. I also think that the way that writing works for me is that you're always trying to build psychological and emotional ramps to particular moments where the characters are really overrun by emotion. And those are the moments where if you slow down and don't run away from it, the language becomes, in an attempt to describe how complicated it is to be a human being in difficult moments, the language gets sensually and psychologically compressed, and it becomes lyric. It rises into the lyric register. And that is the writer's way of singing. You know, the cleavage between music and storytelling is fairly recent in our history. You know, the first word of the Iliad is sing, goddess of the anger of Peleus' son and its devastation. That's what it used to be about. There was a clear idea that the language itself had a kind of melody to it and a rhythm, and these kind of crescendos that were built into stories. So that's what I'm always writing towards. The moment when a character is in some kind of exalted state and the language has to become sort of charged and lyric in order to accommodate that, or musical would be the easier way to say it.
Sweet.
You should have spelled cleavage, by the way, when you said cleavage.
It's two E's, right?
Okay, I got one more, and then I'm going to hand it off to the crowd here, who probably have questions of their own. And I just, we're all three fathers of young children. And for you guys, I want to know how becoming a father has or has not changed your writing, your work in any way. Mm-hmm. Has it pushed you in any directions, or...
I went through this phase for about 6 months where whenever I felt like there was a problem with a story, I just told my students, put a baby in it. I just felt like it just raised the, like that's the way to raise the emotional stakes, isn't it? You just, okay, put a baby in it. but I think I got out of that. Right? But I got out of that phase. It's a good question. It's a hard one. Yeah. I mean, I do think that sometimes you can have characters who aren't responsible for anything. And I think that's really what I'm reaching for when I say put a baby in it. It's like, what is this character responsible for?
Right.
What are they caretaking? You know? And sometimes it's just themselves or some vision of themselves or... some old version of themselves. Sometimes it's another person, you know, but it's a good question to ask yourself as a writer is, okay, what matters to this person and how are they shepherding it in a way that shows their love for it? And so that's really what I mean when you say, you know, put the baby in the story.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that helped, I think, in that regard.
Yeah, I don't think that having I don't really have a direct answer to that. But I can say that I think that a lot of what I was doing, like a lot of your life, basically before you have kids, unconsciously is auditioning for having kids, trying to develop the adequate attention and patience to be able to not
totally screw up a child or two or three. I don't have some inspirational landing on that. Like, I feel like some days at the keyboard I'm doing good work and I'm paying attention and I'm loving my characters, and some days as a dad I'm doing that work, and then most days I'm sort of messing it up and screwing up and missing opportunities and letting my attention drift in both of those phases. And I wish that I sort of was like, oh, I have kids and I see the world a new way, but it's much more like, well, how do I manage to honor both of these undertakings? Because they're both really serious. And I'm sort of freaked out and overmatched by both of them, frankly. And so that's mainly what I do, is sort of try to forgive myself, do what I can with each of those things. And it also puts in perspective, like, you know, I want to write, I want to do good writing, but it's not the top priority anymore.
Right, right,
so you
right.
sort of go, okay, well, in a weird way, it lowers the pressure somehow. It's happening over there.
Okay, do we have questions from the audience? I've warmed you guys up.
So, can you tell me, after you complete your first draft, what's your first next step for editing and improving your work?
After the first draft.
You want to take this one?
Well, the main thing about revision, I mean, the main thing about getting better as a writer is that you have to develop this thing called critical faculty, which is the capacity to, judge the decisions you've made without judging your talent as a writer. And, the central thing that I do when I look at a draft is just say, all right, what are the moments where it seems true, and what are the moments where I'm just pushing the language around? Because the language is the most precise instrument of truth that exists, at least for writers. That's when language is working on the page, it's because it's truthful. You say, oh, we're all in love, it's because it's beautiful. No, that's nonsense. Beauty is a byproduct of sustained attention and pursuit of the truth. It's the residue of it. What I mostly try to do is just get rid of all the false notes, where I'm just basically insecure about the story, and so I'm showing off with the language because I'm not really there in the moment with the characters. That sounds like an easy thing to do, but it ends up taking a long time, and it's tough.
Yeah. And I that's great. I completely agree with that. And then I guess I would also add that in a first draft, after a first draft, I'm still figuring out what the story is about. I mean, it's still messy in a first draft. And so when I go back into it, I'm just writing to kind of figure things out.
Right.
It's not at a point of polishing or anything like that. I'm, you know, in the first draft of the novel, for instance, I'm thinking about, you know, the stuff I read to you tonight was not even the first chapter. It didn't exist. There was a completely different section that was going to open the book, and Miha was not as central as she was, and I had to figure out who she was, and then I had to do research and all this stuff. So, yeah, I'm still writing to figure out things. I'm still working in the dark, and so I go back in and I try to just get closer to what the emotional core of the story is. Mm-hmm. I can't not be concerned about language because I want things to be pretty, but at the same time I know that some of that dressing is going to just disappear because it's unimportant.
And it's okay for it. It's just the scaffolding.
Right.
But it's true, like in the story I read about the UFOs, like that was just me writing about sort of just doing what I do, putting somebody in an awkward situation. What do? You have this sort of friend who's not really a close friend who suddenly hits you with this weird confession. But the story is really about how we all want a caretaker, our dads or God or whatever. And the dad is really at the center of that, this unexpected figure. And he only came into the story in, I don't know, third or fourth draft. And then you realize, oh, it's really about him.
Right.
It's really about this dad apologizing for being a negligent dad, for not realizing the big lesson that these aliens or this shared fantasy has bestowed on him. So sometimes you are kind of just driving in the blind, and you have to trust that your artistic subconscious usually makes better decisions than you do.
Yeah.
Generally knows more than you do.
questions if folks can.
What is it that's so hard about writing a novel that you have
trouble
getting other
performance? Well, I don't know. Let's ask my psychoanalyst. I don't know. You know, if I think that people have different, as writers, I think they have different talents and different skills, and some people, the novel feels like a very natural form to spend a long time with a set of characters, to develop plot lines that have a kind of complex architecture, to commit to characters for that length of time. And my strengths are sort of in psychological and emotional revelation, but I just, I think just intuitively, I'm used to and feel more comfortable and at home in the short story form where it's really condensed. And I try to write novels, but they are just failures, almost inevitably. And I don't mean like, oh, I think they're failures. Like, my wife falls asleep listening to Now, like, false modesty, like, there's this great...
No, they are, yeah.
They're failures. They are failures. But that's okay. I mean, that's part of what, a writing career is mostly about failing. So it's okay. In other words, it's good to have some, or not good, but it's necessary in some ways to have your Valhalla, you know, to have your white whale that you're going after, and in the meantime, to produce the other work for which you put less pressure on yourself. The novel, in a way, has become this sort of this thing that's got this weird mojo hanging over.
Yeah, I hate that.
But in the meantime, and that's a lot of that is market pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Edith Perlman. And Flannery O'Connor wrote a brilliant novel, but Edith Perlman doesn't worry about writing a novel.
Alice Munro doesn't. George Saunders.
George Saunders has never written a novel, and that's fine. They've probably made their peace with it. I'm still a good Jewish boy. I'm still guilt-ridden. Like,
where's the novel?
Thanks for college. No novel.
These other books are fine.
Well, we like them. They're very entertaining.
But I we're getting off track here when we talk about just the novel being kind of idolized as like the end all and be all, but it's something that annoys me too. Why? I mean, I actually don't think it's necessarily harder. It's just different. Like, it requires a different skill set. It's like saying, well, is pole vaulting harder than, you know, the 100-yard dash or something? I don't know. It's just two different forms of athleticism that are involved. And so... it might be harder, like Steve was saying, because you have a different skill set, but I just don't see it as this thing that every writer is striving to create, you know. So do it or don't. Or.
But thank you for your question.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
So you have failures.
Right.
You have failures that then lead some learning and you want to reconfigure and it moves you in a new direction. And you have failures where you just sit, this is deep six, everything here. So what percentage of those are tossed in the room?
Have you done the calculation on that?
Oh, God, that's not something you should know about yourself, right?
Yeah.
If you do the math, that's probably... I mean, there's stories that I've just deleted... And so I don't even, they're not there to remind me that they're failures, which is good. When I was in grad school, I actually house sat for one of my professors. And because, you know, some of your professors, you idolize them a little. I was kind of looking at I thought there might be a secret on his desk that would tell me how to write. So I was looking at his desk and there was a stack of papers there and it was the name of the novel. And then he had actually written underneath it, failed novel. And so I don't keep things around like that. I couldn't do that. I thought that was kind of amazing. But I don't know if there's a percentage that I can even calculate. I think there are stories that I write that just die, and they die. Then there are other ones that die, and I take parts of them. You know, mad scientist kind of thing. It's like, well, that one little section is good. And so then that becomes something for something else. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of failure there. But you definitely, everything you learn and...
Yeah, sometimes it's just a matter of, like, I don't think the people who are great writers or published writers are, like, inherently talented or have the thing. I just think they outlast their doubt.
Right, right.
They just keep slugging away. So, you know, I don't mean to be, like, zen about this. If I was, like, tried to join Buddhism, I would immediately double their anxiety level among a single person. But you have to believe, otherwise you really will get into a horrible, unproductive shame spiral. You have to believe that any time you spend at the keyboard is time in heaven.
Yeah.
You have to believe that, even if you aren't attentive to your characters, even if you're not feeling it, even if you're making bad decisions, because eventually you get tired of the bad decisions. I think people improve by getting tired of their own bad decisions. Yeah. That's the human arrangement.
Right.
You just get fed up with not telling the truth about the things that matter to you. So, that, you know, I wrote this 850-page horrible novel that was just, oh, God. And then it was so awful. And then this was the one that I read to my wife when she fell asleep. And she got like 5 pages in. It was not really good. I was like, wait, it gets better. So, but that led to what? Me getting depressed, and then me being stripped of my writerly vanities, the idea that you have to write a novel, you have to do this or that. And I wrote the book essentially that I could write, which was a silly, crazy nonfiction book about candy and what I really wanted to write about. You know, so sometimes it's a good thing to have desperation as your MO, to be stripped of your vanities.
Yeah.
Your illusions. Maybe one more question, if there is one. Yeah. You, sir, in the blue blazer that screams yacht.
The question about following your gut, I was in a writing class recently and describing a story, and the teacher said, why is it that the two people in love turn out to be half-siblings? And I said, well, it just seemed to me that should happen. And
it seemed to you that what?
That should happen.
That should happen.
And he said, well, you know about Marilyn Robinson? And I think so, yeah. And she said, you should have 5 reasons for why a character should do anything that a character does. So I was wondering about you.
Wow.
Wow.
5.
I don't know about 1 good reason. This is... Hold on, we have to pretend to answer the serious question.
Yeah, how are we going to get around this? I don't know. I mean... those are two separate threads in a way. I'm trying to answer this very sincerely. I think one is like a backstory, an event in the piece that you've written, right, which involves these characters' relationships.
Yeah.
And then the second half of this, I think what Marilyn Robinson is saying, wonderful writer, by the way, is that in terms of the motivations of your characters, what they're actually creating through their actions. And I mean, I don't know about attaching a number to that, but I do. I mean, I'd like to think about my characters' motivations in a way that is complicated. You know, I think people do things for a wide variety of reasons, and often those reasons are in conflict with one another. And oftentimes, like, I think one of the things Steve does particularly well is that he has characters who aren't, they're like lurching towards self-awareness, but they're not quite there yet. And so we see the complicated reasons why they're doing things, but they don't quite understand them yet. So I think all those kind of, I mean, in a way you got good advice there. It might be a little round hole square peg kind of thing, because the detail you just started the conversation with wasn't necessarily about character motivation though. So yeah, but I do think people should do things, your character should do things for complicated reasons, if for no other reason, because that's kind of how we behave in real life, you know. It really, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have 5 reasons. I mean, like, everybody's got their own processes, they've got their own dogma and their own rat, and that works for them, but I always sort of caution people. It's like, you got to figure out what works for you.
Right.
If in your gut these two people are half-siblings and you've created that complication, it's not a Jane Austen novel, it's another kind of novel.
Right.
So
it's,
you know,
maybe E.M. Forrester, who didn't rely on that kind of thing. You know, one thing, another thing, maybe, because we're talking about a particular story of yours, my instinct is not to cut, never cut first, right? So if that advice is leading you to cut that because you don't have, you feel like, oh, I can't justify this, it's in there for some kind of reason. And my guess is, like, work on figuring out why that reason is there. Why does this detail seem important to you? And so that other readers can see that and that kind of thing. Don't feel like, oh, ouch, I'm getting kind of knocked back by that advice, and now I should just take that detail out because I can't justify it.
I wish I'd read a little bit further into that filth, because what's happening what's happening in that scene as it continues he wakes up in the morning and he's slept with this woman, and he has this moment of confusion where he wakes up kind of disoriented. He's in a strange house that has a particular smell, and he thinks he's lying next to his sister. And there's this kind of very deep confusion that he has. That's how we feel about our family members. We love them and hate them, and it's very complicated. I love stuff that doesn't shy from that, because that's who you end up writing about your whole life, is your family. You just find disguises for them. I see a young man in front of
us. We should take him as the last question. What is your question?
Yes, sir. Not only have I, but I will bring a copy up this weekend. It's called Coco Cacciatorean and the Chocolate Crunch.
I write children's books all the time with my son. They're all collaborations, but they don't get published by Knopf or Harper's Collins or anything like that. We just have one. So in a way, I'm like always thinking about those kind of stories, but no, I've never published a children's book.
Yeah, I find myself in this weird situation where I tell long stories to the kids. That's what you figure out after a while. Go serial. You know, because then you have the same set of characters and they want to know. So I've got these two characters who fly around visiting different planets where everybody inevitably farts. That's common theme of the universe.
See, you got them. Palm of your hand.
That's my demographic, and the same thing is apparently the rest of you. Maybe we've got a new affair. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You guys gonna talk next?